Good morning and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the FBN Holdings Half Year 2015 Results Conference Call. Following the brief overview by FBN Holdings management team, an interactive Q&A session will be available. I would now like to hand the call over to Mr. Bello Machado, the Group Chief Executive Officer of FBN Holdings. Please go ahead, sir.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Let me, on behalf of all of us from FBN Holdings, say that we are delighted to present our group's financial results for half year 2015, ended June 30th, 2015. I think the big story for Nigeria is the successful conduct of the general elections and the successful handover of power to President Buhari. Unfortunately, Buhari's government has inherited what I call low oil prices, which have impacted on external reserve position of the country, with its attendant effect on declining revenues for the federal government and for a number of states of the federation. In addition, we have also witnessed a devaluation of our currency as a result of pressure on our foreign reserve position, first from 155 to 168, and then to 195, and then the subsequent closure of the Abuja's window by the Central Bank of Nigeria. So this has had the attendant effect of creating or escalating two markets in this environment, with wide disparity between the parallel and the official exchange rate. The third issue has to do with the fact that we have also seen a harmonization of the cash reserve ratio by the Central Bank of Nigeria to 31%, and this has had additional impact of tightening money supply in a way that has also had impact on cost of funds generally. Despite this terrain that we have highlighted, we are happy to report that our half-year numbers for 2015 are a market improvement from the half-year 2014, starting with our gross earnings that have jumped by 28%, all the way cascading to profit before taxes that have moved from 48.3 billion to 52.1 billion, signaling 8% growth. We have also maintained consistency in terms of deposit growth, even though that has been modest, while also maintaining very healthy pre-tax return on average equity ratio of 19.2%, at a time when we have also succeeded in bringing our cost-to-income ratio significantly down from 65.5% to 61.2%, while also maintaining a healthy CAR Basel II ratio of 18.8%. So, in a nutshell, I mean, our numbers have been very progressive given the very tough terrain that we have operated, and this can be further highlighted by the fact that cost-to-income ratio has continued to decline in Q2 to 58.5%. Having given this highlight, I think it's necessary to just say a few words in terms of what are the key things that are impacting our business in this year and through the year 2015 and beyond. The first is the issue of capital. For us at FBN Holdings Group, our review of the financial market situation, especially the capital market situation, has recognized the fact that there have been depressed valuation levels in the market generally, and that the market has also been impacted by low liquidity. As a result, we feel that raising Tier 1 capital will not be a thing of value, but one that will bring diminution in terms of impact to our existing shareholders. So because of that, our decision is not to raise Tier 1 capital. But how do we now raise our capital in this environment? Number one, increased retention of profit, just like we have done last year, where we actually departed from our traditional situation of high dividend payout. So we will be reducing our dividend payout in a way that we can retain most of our profit. Number two, we have also introduced interim capitalization of profit, which will see us undertaking audit twice in a year so that we're able to capitalize at half year as well as at full year. And overall also, you will see that this year we have actually been on a very modest loan growth, which we expect to sustain through through the year. So these are basically the approaches that we intend to implement to be able to show up our capital. The other issue has to do with the oil price decline. Of course, oil price decline is an issue because for the industry, a significant percentage of the loan portfolio is in oil and gas. And for us at FBN Holdings Group, we have hedge contracts in place that are designed to protect the bank and the group from price risk. But overall, I must also acknowledge that oil companies themselves are slowing down on capital expenditure, and they're also increasing production to improve their cash flows. But having said this, we have also as a group restructured some of our upstream accounts to realign them with the realistic cash flow position. And we believe this is a way to mitigate the risk of being exposed to low oil price decline. The third issue that is impacting on our business this year is the issue of currency devaluation. Again, because for the industry, some percentage proportion of loans are in foreign currency. But for us as a group, what we have done is to ensure that a good proportion of our foreign currency loan book is backed by foreign currency cash flows to provide a natural hedge for us. But overall, we have bigger exposure to the big manufacturing companies that have bigger capacity, if you will, to withstand the impact of currency devaluation than if you are more exposed to the smaller retail operators. But overall, we are expecting to see a targeted slowdown in our exposure to oil and gas as a group. So this brings us to the fourth issue, that given this tough operating terrain, efficiency becomes an important consideration for us as a group. And what we have done to ensure that we drive efficiency across the group, number one is to rationalize our procurement processes. We are also rationalizing unprofitable branches at a time when we are also reducing significantly branch expansion. At the same time, this year we have embarked on rationalizing workforce. About 500 plus of our workforce was actually possible in a way to ensure that we bring our workforce level to a more manageable, more efficiency level. So these are the three areas that we have focused on, in addition to other areas that are designed to bring cost control, that we have already begun to see the positive impact on our cost-to-income ratio. Having highlighted these four themes that have been impacting our business, and we expect them to continue further down the year 2015 and beyond, I guess the big question now is, what is the outlook for us as a business as we go through this year 2015? If you look at our guidance numbers, starting with deposit growth, one would say that even though we have started on a very modest footing with 2.5% growth over the half year, we expect to grow between 5-10% through the course of 2015. Likewise, on the loan growth, this year we are reporting that quite as distinctive from the huge growth we had in 2014 of 23.2%, in the half year 2015, we have actually reduced our loan book, and we are expecting that overall our loan book will grow by just something in the neighborhood of 2%, and that includes the impact of devaluation. Cost to income ratio, we have highlighted that we are at 16.5%, but that we are guiding on 63%, just to be conservative. Of course, cost of risk is at 3.5%, and our return on average equity, we are also guiding on 12 to 14%, basically to reflect the overall difficult general operating terrain. But I must acknowledge that basically this is just being on the conservative side. Having given you some of our key guidance numbers, let me at the same time highlight the fact that we continue to be a stock that is very cheaply priced in the marketplace by virtue of our PE ratio being just 3.3%, which is quite distinctive from our competitors in the industry. Likewise, our price to book is at 0.5 times. So given the expectation that we are still awaiting the National Pension Commission's release of investment guidelines that will bring the pension fund administrators into the stock of financial holding companies, we expect that the price of our stock to adjust proportionately in a way that it will closely approximate its intrinsic value. So on this note, and by presenting you this background, we are essentially at this point inviting you for any questions, any comments, any observations regarding our presentation, as well as regarding the general operations of the group for the half year 2015. Thank you. So we'll be happy to take questions at this point in time.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question over the telephone, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Please ensure the mute function on your telephone is switched off to allow your signal to reach your question. If you find your question has already been asked, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing *2. Once again, press *1 to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to allow participants to signal. Our first question comes from Josh Levin from Citi. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good afternoon. If the Naira devalues to, say, roughly 240, where do you think your NPLs and cost of risk will peak?
Okay. Take this question. Okay. Thank you for your question. At the beginning of the year, we already anticipated that there was going to be a significant devaluation of the Naira. And we have factored it into the way we do business. We had guided on NPL ratio of 5% at the beginning of the year, and we are actually keeping to this. Essentially, we had remained focused not on loan growth, but really loan management, remedial management, and so on and so forth. And we are very confident that notwithstanding the devaluation, the NPL ratio will remain within 5%. However, that is not to say that we don't appreciate the trend in NPL ratio, which was about 3.9% at the end of quarter one and has gone up to 4.1% at half year. We expect things to go worse before they get better, but we still maintain that NPL ratio will remain within the 5% that we have forecasted. I'll also talk about the cost of risk, which has gone up to 2.1%, although we guided at 1.5%. But this is a reflection of the general adverse credit environment. Government employees not being paid, government contractors not being paid, availability and pricing of FX as a problem. So essentially, the credit environment is not so good. Which is why we are increasing our guidance from 1.5% maximum to no more than 3.5%. This is in recognition of the adverse credit environment, not just that of the valuation. Thank you.
So one follow-up question, if I may. You know, oil, Brent oil is somewhere in the low 50s right now. Was it 60 not too long ago? Where is the next break point at which credit becomes a much bigger problem? I mean, how much worse is oil being at 50 versus 60? And if it goes to 40, how much worse is $40 oil versus $50 oil? Is it a linear relationship, or maybe you could enlighten us on that? Thank you.
Yes. The deterioration in the portfolio is not directly related to the price of oil. The extent of deterioration is to increase the proportion of oil and gas, particularly the upstream segment, in, as a percentage of our total loans. Because even by that devaluation, there's an increase because we report in Naira. So there is no direct linkage, really, between the deterioration in the loan portfolio and the devaluation. Except for the fact that if you have a non-performing loan that is dollar-denominated, that would then aggravate the percentage of non-performing loans. But that's not to say that it is the actual devaluation that affects the quality of loan portfolio. Although there is a relationship, but not a direct relationship.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Larni Bulu of Premiera Africa. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen and ladies. On the 2% loan growth, I mean, that's pretty much flat. I mean, is it, I mean, I know you mentioned the environment, but is it really, there's no quality obligors at all that you think, or is it also a function of your capital retention and capital adequacy requirements? Also, any update on Atlantic Energy and what's going on with that particular transaction? And I know BC has been quite vocal about the valuation. If you mind, can you share what you think the Naira and the dollar, where it should be, you know, based on what you've seen in regard to transaction? And the momentum of the foreign currency related revenues that you guys had, which has been quite impressive, should we expect that that to be tapered going into the third and fourth quarter? That's it for now for me. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take the question about the 2% loan growth that we are guiding. If you look at our numbers, hello?
Sorry.
If you look at our numbers, we actually had a 3.2% year-to-date decline in the loan portfolio. And we had also mentioned the fact that the credit environment is very adverse. So this is not really the time to grow loans aggressively. And I think across the entire banking industry, I don't see any bank that is looking at growing loans aggressively. So the 2% that we are guiding us, I think we believe in, is a prudent way to go. Thank you. Then you wanted to know about Atlantic Energy. Since the last time we talked about Atlantic Energy at the conference call, there has not been significant improvement in this credit. However, it is still watchlisted. It is still watchlisted and is performing. The good news that we have here is the fact that the investor that wants to buy into Atlantic Energy, which will bring the much-needed financial and managerial support, is still very much interested given the attractiveness of the assets, underlying assets under the exposure. We are very much aware of the bad press surrounding this, but we are engaging with the company, we are engaging with NMPC and MPDC, and we are looking at getting assurances so that the investor will bring the money and will help resuscitate the business of this company.
If I would like to add, let me reiterate that the Atlantic Energy transaction was to finance the strategic alliance agreement with NPDC, in which funding is provided and to be repaid by listing. Whatever happens, the structure of the transaction provides and allows First Bank to step into the shoes of Atlantic Energy in case of default, and that option is
conditional upon getting the consent of NPDC. We confirm that we have all the structures in place. Whilst we are putting the account on watch list, we are also comforted by the fact that in the worst case scenario, the oil block related to this transaction is producing. The results are huge in billions of dollars, and in the worst case scenario, we have the right to step into the shoes of Atlantic Energy and repair as a means of also recovering the outstanding exposure. That's the current situation of things on the Atlantic.
And your take on the naira dollar value exchange rate?
Well, this is or nothing I'm speaking. I had made some comments earlier on Bloomberg, and it's also instructive to know that no matter how I feel as an individual or as the CEO of an organization, it's the central bank who has the primary responsibility for determining and managing exchange rate. Feel strongly that they would defend the naira at current exchange rate. I have no option but to abide by their pronouncement and support them as much as possible to achieve that objective of exchange rate stability. So at this point in time, I don't have a contrary position to what the central bank has pronounced, and we are working hard to support them in achieving this objective. So I stand by the central bank pronouncement on exchange rate forecast. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Tulu Amintu from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hosting today's call. I just have a few quick questions, please. The first is on your exposure to government parastatals, specifically NMPC. There's been some talk about NMPC moving deposits to the CBN. I just wanted to know what impact that would have on your total deposits and on your loan-to-deposit ratio. Secondly, on, I think, slide 19 of the presentation that you kindly sent out to us, you show that there's been a lengthening in the maturity of your or the duration, rather, of your loan book, and you now have 17% or so of loans with 5 years or more to maturity. I just wanted to know whether that relates to the restructuring or renegotiation of the oil and gas loans, and maybe you could give us some figures for how much was renegotiated or restructured. Thirdly, since we have the CEO on the line, it would be great to maybe get an update on when we might see his replacement announced, and maybe some color on what he might be doing next. And lastly, there was a decline in FX deposits in the second quarter. Was that corporates withdrawing their FX deposits or retail? If you can shed more light on that, it would be really helpful. Thank you.
Sorry, on the NMPC withdrawal, yes, it is correct that NMPC has commenced withdrawing some of their balances from across the industry. However, it's important to note that it is in a phased manner over a couple of months. Thus far, the impact on us has been nominal. To the extent, it's been nominal because that is safe, and for the first call, we've made those repayments in line with the call for the deposit. Now, we have, with respect to dollar liquidity, we have no issues around that. And we're able to meet their payments and their demands as and when they want them.
I guess regarding the issue of replacement of the GMD of First Bank, let me begin by saying that we are working with the timetable of announcing a replacement on or before the end of Q3. So that announcement is going to be made well ahead of the date of his exit, which will be end of December, to allow for very robust handover process that will ensure that the stability of the institution continues on the right momentum. Let me use this opportunity to say that we have very strong management team internally, executive management team internally, with six executive directors, and any one of them has the capability to be able to carry the torch further down the road after the exit of the Kibisi Anasai. But having said this, let me also state that a robust process has been put in place, working with an international firm to ensure that a process is implemented that will ultimately bring out the best candidate that will be most appropriate for the marketplace and for the environment in which we operate today. So I just want to assure the marketplace that the whoever emerges from this process will be one that will continue to sustain the momentum of FirstBank Group into the future. Having said this, since the GMD is here himself, it's good for you to hear his voice in terms of what he intends to do when he leaves in December.
Okay, let me reiterate that I have absolute confidence in the existing executive management team. Indeed, the process has commenced for the selection of my successor. It's a very thorough and transparent process that will ensure that whoever comes out of it deserves to keep the job, and I can assure you that there will be no disappointment. We are very strong internal people, and I'm part of that process. In terms of what I will do next, I'd like to say that it's important to know when to leave. It's not a question of what you want to do. I have put in 30 years into banking service. It's nice for me to take a break and look up to something else to do. Whatever that thing is, God knows. But what is not right is to continue to stay longer on the job when you have a tenor policy that you have to respect. So when there are opportunities, if there are other things I'd like to do, that will be personal, and that will be for those who would be interested as my friends, they will get to know. But right now, I'm just focused on running out the remaining terms, focusing on succession, and making sure that at the end of it all, the bank is much stronger than it is today, even after I have departed. So I'm pretty much focused on just doing what I'm doing now, and then exiting gloriously at the end of the year to allow somebody else to take over the decision. Thank you very much.
I think there was a question asked about the lengthening of the loan book.
Yes.
You found page 19.
Yes.
You're absolutely correct. The lengthening of the maturity of the loan book is due to some of the restructuring that we carried out in the upstream oil and gas sector. We remain comforted by this restructuring, given the high quality of the underlying assets. And essentially, we used a very conservative $45 a barrel to project all the cash flows in order to be comfortable enough for this restructuring. Thank you.
Thank you. If I could have just a quick follow-up question, if you don't mind. What's the size of or the amount of loans that you have restructured from that sector, please?
Well, I can give you for the entire portfolio is about 11%, but for oil and gas about 6%. But there are some that are still in process.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Suji Shalanke of Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for the call. This is Suji Shalanke from RenCap. I have a few questions, please. The first one goes to Imi. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear what you said around NNPC. So if you can kindly please repeat what you said. I think my questions are probably more around in what this could potentially mean for, should I say, your balance sheet structure overall, you know, the withdrawal of NNPC deposits. My second question is around asset quality. If the chief risk officer can please expand further around the drivers of the higher NPL and cost of risk guidance? And just a bit more in terms of what exactly is driving the more conservative guidance from your end. My third question is around the bailout that was recently announced for the state. What proportion of your loan book is to state government, and how much are you potentially expecting that could, you know, offset? Because what you understand is, you know, bonds replace these loans. What could it potentially mean for your balance sheet, you know, if and when this does come into play? My fourth question is around, at the moment, how big is your trade finance book? So that portion of the book that is, you know, trade related. Thank you very much.
He said he didn't hear you.
Like I said, NMPC has commenced the withdrawal of some of its deposits. Important to say that it's not all its deposits that are held in Nigerian banks, right? Now, it is a phased process over a couple of months, and the withdrawals are being made in tranches. And thus far, the first call has been made, and we have made the payments to its accounts with the central bank on schedule, and we'll continue to do so over the period. Now, with respect to the balance sheet, like I said, given that it's not all of the deposits that are being taken, and the fact that we have a significant spread of deposits from predominantly corporate clients, we don't envisage a fundamental structural shift in the nature of our balance sheet. In addition to that, we do have access to other sources of wholesale funding, and we are tapping those. What you may see is that we look to distribute more of our loans or short-term trade finance type assets and other things to various providers to create the necessary liquidity to support our customers. So I don't think there will be a significant structural shift. Bearing in mind, there's been significant growth in corporate foreign currency deposits across the sector.
Okay, so you asked the question about what is driving the impairment charges, and as we mentioned in the report, is due more to increased collective impairment taking on performing loans. I had mentioned during the course of this presentation the fact that the credit environment is extremely adverse. So even loans that are still performing, we expect that we should not expect that historical losses under a normal scenario will be same as the kind of scenario where we have government revenues declining sharply, government employees not being paid, contractors, and so on and so forth. So this is actually driven by more by collective impairment on performing loans rather than specific impairment on non-performing loans.
And let me just add that as executive management also, we are very proactive. Even on accounts that are classified as performing today, when we see signals that there are likely indications that the accounts are under watch list or likely to be challenged, we take a view, a very proactive view of what the outcome will be, even if it would get worse before getting better. So that's the collective decision we're taking, and that has been factored into the guidance number that we're providing. So it's just not in respect of existing classified accounts, but our own perception of likely situations in which certain accounts that we put on the watch list may or may not work in. And so we're taking a view along that line, and that has guided our outlook in terms of what the NPL will be and the cost of risk. It's a proactive measure. Thank you.
Okay. So you also asked a question on the government exposure that is likely to be affected by the buyback that the government wants to do. We're looking at about 6% of the portfolio, which is roughly 110 billion. Then you also asked a question about the size of the trade finance book. That's about 10% of our portfolio. But remember that the trade finance typically
cycles out very, very quickly. So even though the number is low, it cycles out very, very quickly.
Yep. If I can just have ask a few follow-up questions. So in terms of the state bailout, isn't this good news for you, just given the tightness of your liquidity and capital adequacy ratio, just given the size of what you're looking at in terms of what you could get in terms of FGN bonds? That's the first thing. The second thing is, I remember the CEO spoke a few weeks, months ago, about how bad the scarcity of FX is interbank. Can you please give us an update in terms of what's currently going on? And my final question would be, on asset quality, right, what sectors are you being more conservative on, or should I say proactive? Thank you.
I will answer the last question. It's not unrelated to the oil and gas sector. Okay?
Okay.
Upstream. It's not unrelated to, we are just being proactive.
Regarding your question on the loan swap and the buyback by the federal government, we think it's capital positive, it's also liquidity positive, even though our liquidity position today is quite strong. But we think it's capital positive for all institutions, including ourselves.
And the final question was on FX scarcity.
Scarcity of FX for the interbank.
In your alphabetical.
With respect to FX liquidity in the market, from the perspective of central bank intervention, in fairness, there's a sense that the central bank has increased the level of its intervention in the market to provide some liquidity. So corporates are still able to access FX. I think that's important to state, though it just generally takes longer to fill their orders. So I would say perhaps some moderate improvement out there.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you find your question has already been asked, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Our next question comes from Muyua Oni of SBG Securities. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the presentation and taking our questions. The first is more a follow-up on your cost of risk guidance. Can you please maybe tell us what type of macro conditions you expect to happen for this cost of risk of 3.5 to crystallize? I understand that they are being proactive, but I also wanted to know what key indicators, where macro indicators could reach before such crystallizes. And then the second is on your e-banking. Can you, because the performance has been impressive over the last over the couple of years, and just wanted to understand what's really been the key drivers and what kind of levers do you see happening that could expand the growth in that sector, because it's clearly been compensating for the reducing COT in your book. And then the third is also linked to in-banking, but on your first money product, it's been impressive growth. Customer acquisition growth has been positive, but can you provide a geographic split of customers across the six regions? I'm just trying to understand how the growth has helped to drive banking penetration, particularly to the unbanked. And then what are the popular products for the platform? And then the last is on the comment you made on your presentation on local currency loans. You talked about increasing that portion. Just wanted to know what short-term opportunities, what sectors do you see opportunities in the short term to increase local currency loans? Thank you.
Okay. Yes, I'd like to talk about the cost of risk, and your question is about the macro indicators that is guiding the collective impairment. I had mentioned during the course of this presentation the fact that government revenues have declined significantly,
and you have a lot of states not having paid salaries for up to 12 months, 1 year. So where salaries are being paid, there's significant delay. We have delays in paying government contractors. Then even leaving that, what about the FX? We all know what the FX environment is like. FX is not available in the right price for a lot of our customers. So, and this has affected even the very, very big corporates. Yeah. Recently, Nigerian breweries, some of the corporates are reporting weaker performances as a result of these environmental conditions. And these are some of the adverse credit environment that is making us increase the collective impairment on performing loans. And I think it was also mentioned by my GMD the fact that even those that are performing, we see signs that some of them are struggling, and there's a need to actually be proactive and increase the collective impairment. Thank you.
As far as our e-banking business is concerned, the key driver for us is we do have a strategic objective to migrate most, if not all, our customers onto our e-banking platform. Today we have the largest customer base, so deliberately we are migrating our customers onto the various e-banking platforms. And you are right, part of the rationale is to reduce the cost of service, but equally important is the charges and the fees that come from migrating them and from the usage of those platforms will come in to help us to plug the reduction in COT. So it is a key strategic platform that we are pursuing, and we still see significant room for further growth in that area. So you will continue to see us pushing quite hard along that line. In terms of on your question on the mobile banking, we do not have the geographic place readily available. We can provide that. But the key thing to highlight there is that it is an integral part of our e-banking business and strategies. We are keen to continue to grow that particular segment of our business because we think it supports the central bank's financial inclusion strategy, and it also plays to our own strength given our heat spread.
Yes, as to your question about what is going to drive local currency part of the loan book, essentially we are looking at retail and there may be some commercial businesses. We're looking at suppliers and distributors of the very, very big manufacturing companies. These are customers who need local currency facilities. And that is a key focus area for going forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kenzia Mishkuina from UBS.
Hi, this is Ksenia Mishkuina from UBS. Thank you for the presentation. I have a couple of questions. Could you please indicate the sensitivity of Naira depreciation on your capital ratios and NPLs? And do you anticipate any regulatory changes in the near term? Thank you.
Any what?
Regulatory changes.
The devaluation of the Naira, the impact on our capital adequacy ratio is something that we had factored in. The impact, strictly speaking, it would grow the size of our loan book, given the fact that we have roughly about 45% of our loan book in foreign currency. So our risk-weighted asset is expected to grow. But this is something that we have modeled into our projection. One of the key reasons why we slow down significantly on loan growth is because that we do realize that the loan book naturally or based on devaluation will grow.
and this has been factored into our capital ratio. So we anticipated it, and we believe we'll be fine, given the fact that we factor it into our capital model right from the beginning of the year.
Yes, let me react to the question about the sensitivity of devaluation on asset quality. Essentially, we have a policy of not extending foreign currency loans to customers who don't earn foreign currency flows. So to this extent, there is a natural mitigant. So the customers that are likely to be affected by devaluation will be people who have a higher cost of sales as a result of imported products. So we don't really think that this will be very significant. Where there will be significant impact is where you have a customer earning Naira and borrowing in foreign currency, and we don't encourage that at all. Where we have it at all, we have it with the very, very big multinationals like the Lafarge, and I'm sure you will agree with me that the Lafarge will have the financial flexibility to handle this kind of risk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And could you please just comment on regulatory changes that you expect in the near to medium term, if you expect any?
Sorry, I didn't get that question.
Regulatory changes. I mean, in what area? If it's around capital, the reality is that the central bank has continued to fine-tune the guideline around Basel II and capital adequacy and internal capital adequacy assessment. So we expect those fine-tuning to continue during the course of 2015. But the reality is that they have also realized that they've already mentioned the fact that if it does have any adverse impact on any bank, people have up to the course of July 2016 to deal with any downside or any consequences of anything, of any of the changes that they have proposed.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from George Murgani of African Alliance. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thanks for the call. I got cut out a little earlier, so sorry if this has already been asked, but I noticed your net interest margin recovered strongly in the second quarter from 6.9% to 7.8%. I was just wondering what drove that recovery, and given that the Treasury yield started climbing in late 2014, I was just wondering how come the pricing adjustment wasn't able to be made in Q1. It looks like the pricing adjustment only came through in Q2.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from Shoige Sri Lanka of Renaissance Capital.
Hi, I just have one follow-up question. Well, two questions actually. So the first one is around the gain you had in Q2. I think it was about 5 billion. Can you please clarify what exactly was behind, you know, the gain that you recorded? And my question is similar to the previous caller's question, which got caught up. Can you please just give us more clarity around how you were able to improve margins in the second quarter of the year? Thank you. And what the outlook for that is as well. Exactly, yeah.
The gain is actually we sold one of our legacy equity positions. If you recall, we highlighted as management that for us, internal capital management, optimizing our balance sheet will be our key primary focus during the course of 2015. And equity positions that are not directly related to our core business, we continue to evaluate the option, the opportunity to evacuate or offload them. So we sold one of our investments. I can confirm clearly to you that it is not what you speculated in your original release. It is not. It has nothing to do with Airtel. But we sold it. It's realized. It's in. Regarding your second question on how we were able to increase margin. Again, strategically, we highlighted at the beginning of the year that for us, loan growth will not be a priority. What will be our strategic priority is optimizing our loan book and ensuring that we achieve appropriate pricing of the portfolio. That is exactly what we have embarked on. We will continue to do that. We believe that it's sustainable in the long run. The name, the equity position I was told to sell is our investment in InterSwitch. When we sold about 2 years ago, we had a remnant that was left, and what we have done now is to sell down completely.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
As a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from Huil Uzlu of Investec Bank.
Good afternoon. My question is basically on your assessment of some of your non-performing branches and the note that about 30 of them are likely to be downgraded or shut down. I'm wondering what, if you can put a number to it, how this will affect your cost line, specifically your cost to your cost improvement. Basically, that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, we have our applications at the central bank to shut down non-profitable branches. These are branches that even after you are factoring in the network effect, they still are not contributing anything to the network. Given the fact that the infrastructure that we have around there is not great, so by shutting those branches, you'll be eliminating the cost of running branches, and we think it could potentially be material, and which is why we've been looking at it. So I won't put a number to it for now, but we think it's part of what is going to help us to get to the desired cost-to-income ratio. And it's going to be a continuous exercise to evaluate branches, evaluate their contribution, and if we think they are not adding much value, then we would either downgrade them or we'll take them out completely, subject, of course, to the approval of the central bank.
All right, thank you.
As a final reminder to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from Adway Olkin-Lloyd from ARM Investment Managers.
All right. Thank you for your presentation. Most of my questions have been asked for. My only question is just on your tax rates for Q2. So I think your tax rates for Q2 jumped about almost 30% in Q2. So I just wanted to ask what drove that in particular, and what's your guidance for full year? Okay, I can see your guidance for full year is between 18 to 20%, but what's the driver of your Q2 jump in tax rate? That's all.
Like you said, our full year guidance remains what it was at the beginning, 18 to 20%, more on the upper end. For the half year, we've explained already that the impairment charge that we took is essentially on performing portfolio, and that doesn't have any tax benefit. But we expect everything to even out in the course of the full year, and we should be arriving at the original guided the number that we guided. So the after one was a temporary blip.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That'll be all.
Our next question comes from Udla Boyd Ulkan from Betvina. Please go ahead.
Thank you for the call. I would like to find out what your dividend guidance for 2015 is. Thank you.
Well, like we highlighted at the beginning of the presentation, because of our attitude in terms of capital retention, or rather deepening up our capital position, we are going to continue on the journey of conservative dividend payout. If you look at last year our dividend payout was a market reduction from what had been in the past. So we expect to continue on that tradition in an effort to ensure that capital is enhanced.
Okay, thank you.
We'll now take a follow-up question from Soige Sralanke from Renaissance Capital. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just have two additional questions. The chairman spoke about the, you know, so this is interest rate. So I'm going through an annual account, and what I see here is you still have, well, what you had at the end of last year was about $55 billion in unquoted investment. So how significant potentially could be one of gains or losses that we could see for the rest of the year? That's my first question. My second question is around costs. So quarter on quarter, Q2 versus Q1, you had a pickup in costs. Can you please shed some color around the pickup we saw in Q2? And what do you think is sort of a more sustainable run rate on cost for First Bank? Thank you.
Regarding the one-off transaction, I will go back to the general policy statement that I mentioned earlier on. That is, we have this equity investment. Some of them are not core to our business. However, we are not in a hurry to dispose of them as in at a loss. We will look at opportunities to dispose of them at what is beneficial to our shareholders. So I think that's the key point. So it will be quite, I wouldn't like to speculate on the size of the one-off that you will likely see in the second half of the year, because even though the assets are there, if the right opportunities for me to sell at the right price that will benefit the shareholders is not there, then we will not do that. On your second question, I didn't quite get exactly what you wanted to also about the cost. Can you take the question on the cost again?
Yeah, my question was just more around, so in Q1 your OPEX was $57 billion, Q2 it was $61 billion. So my first question on that was what drove the pickup in OPEX in Q2? And my additional question on that was, what's a more sustainable quarterly run rate for costs for First Bank?
Okay, the key thing in Q2, we mentioned in our presentation that we had this severance arrangement where we took out about 500 staff that we do not think will fit into the First Bank of the future. And in order to make the separation amicable, we had to pay severance costs. So that is a significant chunk of that happened in the first half of the year. In terms of our run rate, the way we look at cost is slightly different. Our focus is more on the cost-to-income ratio. We deploy a number of initiatives that will bring down our cost, and we continue to implement them. It's difficult for me to say this is what it will be. For example, if in a particular month electricity supply is very weak, what you will see across our network is that the cost of diesel will pick up materially. So our strategic focus is to continue to push down on the cost-to-income ratio. We are achieving results, and we continue to push in that direction. So for us, we are not trying to isolate different things. We know the different levers, and we are pulling the different levers as and when opportunity presents itself.
In addition to what the CFO has said, it's important we put on the table that one of the things that hurts our cost-income ratio is a very huge balance we have in cash reserve requirements. As we speak, we have 650 billion naira in cash reserve requirements. One of the top three tier one banks has just half of that. And if you remunerate, even at treasury rate, the differential between us and that top tier one bank, which is in excess of 300 billion, even at treasury bills rate, we are talking of additional 30 billion naira on an annual basis in terms of revenue. Now, we model that out. If we are remunerated on an equated basis, based on that high CRR, we would have had a cost-income ratio of about 55%, and ROE would have been in excess of 25%. So we keep appealing to Central Bank, and we are glad that at the last MPC, we had four members of the MPC voting in favor of paying some interest on cash reserve requirement. If we win that battle, it will be a significant upswing and a normalization and readjustment of our numbers in relation to our competitors. So we believe that this is one of the things that has been holding us down,
And because we are a very big bank, it is a major advantage to us. We want to appeal to those of you who are also analysts to help us put pressure for some form of remuneration on the very high figures of capital requirement. This will help us to normalize our position and put us where we really should be as a very profitable institution.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just have a follow-up question for the CFO. So on the divestment, is there any sort of pressure coming through from the central bank for you to divest of non-core investment? So in other words, is there any sort of timeline over which you have to get this done or not?
Yeah, there's no timeline. Like I said, we look at opportunity to sell at a rate of price that is profitable for our shareholders. So we will continue to look at that opportunity.
Now, let me add also that even if central bank does not ask us to divest, it's a business decision and it helps our capital position for us to divest. What we would never do, however, is to be desperate. And when you are desperate, you don't get the best value for your shareholder, which is why we remain open to divestment. We will consider the options when they come in, but we will not sell our peanuts. I will not undervalue. I will not do anything that would make us lose those investments and sell at ridiculous prices. So we are pursuing the opportunities to sell, but we would also not throw them away without getting what we perceive as the real value of those investments. So it's a business decision rather than a regulatory decision. For us. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
There are no questions at this time. I would like to hand the call back to Mr. Bello Makido for any closing remarks. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, for all of us at FBN Holdings, basically to thank participants for being part of this conference call, and we appreciate your questions, your comments, and your observations throughout this period. Thank you very much, sir. Look forward to seeing you for end of year.
This concludes the FBN Holdings Half-Year 2015 Financial Results Call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.